If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
History has been totally sanitized by the French historians. You know, they don't talk about these massacres at all, except for saying, you know, oh, a few anti-revolutionaries, counter-revolutionaries were got rid of. But it was practically a genocide in the west of France.
That was Stephen Clark on the French Revolution.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. In today's episode, we're going to be speaking to the writer Stephen Clark, who's made his name writing humorous books about France, including A Thousand Years of Annoying the French. His latest book, released just a few days ago, takes a sideways look at the French Revolution. And this was the subject of his conversation with our staff writer Ellie Cawthorn.
So I'm joined by Stephen Clark today, who's the author of a myth-busting new account of the French Revolution. So, of course, the revolution is a classic in the history textbooks. But what you suggest, Stephen, is that a lot of what we think we know isn't actually correct. I wonder whether you could just start by running us through some of the biggest misconceptions people have about the French Revolution.
Sure, yes. Well, the first one is that there is this idea that suddenly on the 14th of July 1789, the Parisians rose up and very democratically attacked this horrific political prison called the Bastille, a castle on the edge of Paris, smashed down its walls, freed the prisoners, and then thereafter, very quickly, the despotic, tyrannical King Louis XVI and his madly overspending wife, Marie Antoinette, were tried, guillotined, a whole bunch of aristocrats were guillotined, and rather neatly, suddenly we had liberté, égalité and fraternité, and which gives us the French Republic as we know it today. That's what they like us to think, and that's the kind of image they project every 14th of July, whereas in fact, almost all of that is completely false. When you go back to, as I did, to the parliamentary archives, to the actual historical accounts of what happened before the Bastille was attacked and all that, you see that it was totally, totally wrong. And this is what I've done in the book, is point out what was really going on, which in fact is a lot more interesting and in many ways a lot more sort of heroic and revolutionary. Because for a start, the Bastille was a very unpleasant prison. However, in July 1789, there were only, I think it was 7 prisoners there. And all of those, none of them were political, and all of them were put back in prison by the revolutionaries anyway. What the Parisians wanted was gunpowder, because they'd already got a load of muskets and they wanted gunpowder in order to have an uprising. They were food riots. The price of bread had gone up. People were poor. They had genuine reasons to complain. However, the reality was, and this is what I describe in the book, that out in Versailles, where the king's palace was, a new democratic parliament had already begun working. The king had summoned a very undemocratic setup with the aristocrats, the clergy, and what they called the third estate, which was with the commoners. He'd summoned them, but the commoners had rebelled against that and said, no, we want a democratic party with one member, one vote, each vote having the same weight. And with the king's cooperation, they'd force that through. So France now, as of May 1789, had a fairly democratic government, which was trying to put through the new democratic tax laws. The French, ordinary French people, were crippled with taxes. They were paying like 50% of everything they earned in tax to these aristocrats who did nothing. They were just landowners. And the king had been trying to change that for years and had unsuccessfully, because the aristocrats had stopped him. And now suddenly, in May 1789, all this was going ahead. There were genuine reforms led by these incredibly sort of courageous and principled French Democrats, whom nobody speaks about now. They were actually reforming the country, and these Parisians rioting were seen as an unfortunate sort of side issue that need to be cured, and that, you know, food issues needed to be addressed, the price of bread and everything. But, you know, democratic reform was going on, and what people wanted was a constitutional monarchy, a British-style monarchy where the king was subject to parliament. And he had rather grudgingly accepted that. So when the Bastille was attacked, in fact, democracy was already happening, not in Paris, but out in Versailles, with the king, and no one wanted to execute the king. And people just don't admit this for some reason. They don't want to admit this.
So the way that we view the French Revolution is very much shaped by hindsight and the knowledge of what came after.
Yes, and by a sort of cleanup act, because what came afterwards was for about almost 3 years, this new democracy was going ahead. They were reforming things. They were writing a new constitution. Now, being French, they were doing a lot of talking and not a great deal of action. And some of the politicians, when you read the parliamentary archives, which are wonderfully detailed, you see that they talked almost all day, every day, 365 days a year. No, they were working very hard. But they were pontificating a lot. And unfortunately, what was happening was that these aristocrats, who still had a measure of power in parliament, were blocking the most radical reforms, especially as regarding to the taxes they were receiving and being dispossessed of their property. They wanted to be paid the full price for their property, whereas the king, for example, gave up some of his palaces without asking for the full price, gave them to the nations. Aristocrats were blocking that. So things were going rather slowly. And it wasn't until 1792 when the people who are now famous, like Robespierre and Danton, who were in fact just the loudest and the most sort of attention-seeking and the most radically anti-monarchist, and they were calling for blood, and it was very populist. They were saying a lot, like extreme French parties do now, both left and right. They say, you know, get on the barricades, protest, and we're with you, we're with you. And that's what Robespierre and Danton were doing. And they whipped up the Parisian crowds into a frenzy. And things, I mean, I'm simplifying slightly, obviously, but things got out of hand and people got impatient. And in 1792, the guillotining started, and there was a complete sort of purge of moderates. And that was when Louis XVI got executed and Marie Antoinette got executed and lots of other people. But what they cover up is the fact that it then descended into a horrific civil war with awful massacres, which I describe in great gory detail. French person on French person. So history has been totally sanitized by the French historians. They don't talk about these massacres at all, except for saying, a few anti-revolutionaries, counter-revolutionaries were got rid of. But it was practically a genocide in the west of France.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/History Extra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Picking up your point about the massacres there, I think we hear a lot about the French Revolution in terms of Louis and Marie Antoinette, and as you say, the top revolutionaries, the ones that shouted the loudest. But we don't hear so much, like you say, about how it affected everyday people. I wonder whether you could give us a sense of what it might have been like to be an ordinary person living through this time in France.
Yes, well, the experiences would have been very different. I mean, in Paris, there were a lot of very poor workers, disenfranchised workers, because in order to vote, a bit like in Britain at the time, you had to pay a certain amount of tax, and lots of them didn't pay tax. Servants weren't allowed to vote either. But they were, lots of those were, you know, really subject to the price of bread. The price of bread was a vital part of the economy. And when bread prices went up, people, you know, were close to starvation. So for long periods, when there were bad harvests or bad weather, which there often was during that period, people came close to starvation, which is why there were riots. Now, and at that point, traditionally, they turned to the king as a sort of benefactor, and they asked for, relief. They asked for aid, and they usually got it. And what the king tried to do, and the parliament, obviously, at the same time now, was get together grain stocks, which they would then distribute to the poor. And this worked for a while, and people, you know, were quite happy with that, and they saw it as the natural part of government. But it's true that out in the country, for example, where you are further away from all this aid and from these grain stocks, I found a wonderful book by a British agriculturalist called Arthur Young, who travelled around France at this time, and he described seeing these poor, starving people out there. He said he walked for a long time with a woman. A peasant woman, and they were talking, and he said she looked as if she was 70, and he asked her age, and she said she was 27, and she described the hard work she had to do to make a pittance of a living. And what he's saying is he doesn't understand that there's all this uncultivated land and these absentee landowners, and that how is it that such a potentially fertile country as France should be so desolate, you know? So you had the poor people who really were suffering. You had the rich aristocrats who, even right up until 1792, the ones who didn't run away into exile, some of them were living fairly comfortably out in their chateaus, a life of absurd privilege, because all they did was take taxes and revenues from their landowners. And they were, you know, the really archetypal, uncaring aristocrats who even got their tenants to work free, for example, repairing the roads and things like that on their estates. Then you had the whole merchant classes who were trying to make France work, because just before the revolution, the economy had actually begun to boom, but this killed it off. So a lot of the bourgeois classes turned into political not agitators exactly, but activists pushing for harder reform and trying to get power away from the aristocrats. And then you had this new generation of revolutionary administrators who gradually mutated into these sort of Stalinist-type political commissars who would be parachuted into these towns and would oversee the revolution. And as things went on through 1792 and into the terror of that period, which lasted up to almost up to 1795, what you'd get would be these bunches of revolutionaries who would go around. If anyone, you could denounce your neighbor. If your neighbor said anything against the revolution, you could denounce them, and they would get executed. If you were tried for tyranny, there were two verdicts: innocent or execution. So people really were living through terror.
You mentioned earlier Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, and these are, of course, two characters which really have not come off well in the history books. Is that unfair? Were they really as horrendous as legend would have us believe?
Well, it's true that Marie Antoinette, she didn't say, "Let them eat cake." That's a myth. But almost certainly, I do examine the reasons for the myth. "Let them eat cake" was a really good, clever piece of fake news, because the lack of bread, as I said, was a really key sign that the economy was going badly. So someone to say "let them eat cake" was horrendously cruel. So when people believe that about her, it really was a very effective piece of propaganda. But she did overspend terribly. She arrived as a sort of she was very young. When she arrived, she was only 14 when she married. She was a prepubescent princess. And at first, people loved her, and she was sort of she gave to charity and all that sort of thing. But after that, very quickly, she was buying earrings that would cost about the price of, I calculated the price of one pair of her earrings in something like a million loaves of bread. And she would borrow money, and, her reputation went down so badly and so quickly that I found all these pornographic plays and sketches that people were writing about her and believing it, how she was sleeping with her husband's brother or other lovers, incest. And people would believe anything about her. And she really dragged the monarchy down. And at one point, some of Louis XVI's allies were saying, send her back to Austria, because, and then you'll be able to stay on. Because people actually genuinely liked Louis XVI. He was, as kings go, as French kings, absolute monarchs go, he was quite a benevolent fellow. He did, throughout his whole career, he did try his best to ease the lot of the poor Parisians. Now, he was living a wonderfully lavish lifestyle at the same time, so it was a bit hypocritical. But he engaged a Swiss economist called Jacques Necker, who tried to push through really radical tax reform to make aristocrats pay tax for a start, and also to enable poor people to work and earn a decent living and actually have prospects for themselves and their children and everything. And people actually quite liked him. On the 14th of July 1790, the first anniversary of Bastille Day, there was a huge celebration in Paris, and Louis XVI was the guest of honour, and the massed crowds of politicians and soldiers and ordinary spectators swore an oath of allegiance to him. There was no question of cutting his head off at all at first. They liked him. It was only when, these reforms couldn't get through because they were blocked, that populists whipped up opinion against him.
So who were some of the other characters that you found most fascinating to research?
Well, one of them was the first president of France. And one of the fascinating things I found was that at first, when it was created, the Assemblée Nationale, which is still the name of the French Parliament today, their presidents, they would only be president for about 2 weeks, and then they would swap. It's wonderful. They were just chairmen of debates. The first president, and he was also later the first mayor of Paris, a fella called Jean-Sylvain Bailly. I'd never heard of him. But when you read what he wrote and what he said, he was a really principled Democrat. He was keeping everyone, all the extremes, in check. He was saying to the more radical revolutionaries, you know, no, we have to, let's consult the king. The king is not going to tell us what to do, but, you know, according to this new constitution that we're writing, everyone has to be consulted, everyone has to agree. And he was pushing laws very slowly through, but using really democratic, principled methods. So it came to no surprise when later on he was sort of framed for a crime and was guillotined. You know, all the moderates, the people like him, were guillotined later on. He was a fascinating fellow. Just for, you know, he was rather boring when he spoke, but he wanted to get things done honestly. You know, well, this fellow Necker as well, this Swiss economist, I'd never heard of him. He again, really boring, really fascinated by writing out his accounts and hugely lengthy, detailed papers on what he intended to do, which I'm sure put half the politicians to sleep. But a really principled man. His wife and he founded a hospital in Paris that is still open today, and they founded it on to help the poor. He also reformed the prison system because he said that being in prison was punishment enough, and so having bad conditions was an extra punishment and shouldn't be allowed. You know, you had these philanthropists working with the king and who were actually trying to do good, but they were, you know, Necker was Swiss, so he managed to escape. Principled, democratically minded people working for peaceful reform, evolution, not revolution. And if they'd been allowed to go ahead, it would have saved hundreds of thousands of French lives in the massacres that followed over the following century, because the revolution actually, it lasted almost until 1870. You know, in 1870, there was almost another monarchy. There was such chaos created by the conditions of the terror and the guillotinings and the rivalries that arose, that the revolution went on for that long.
So, of course, the full title of your book is The Revolution and What Went Wrong.
Yeah.
We've kind of just been discussing this, but I wonder, is that what you see as the main thing that went wrong in the revolution, the purging of moderates?
Yes, the descent into violence, the descent into populism. You know, one of the most famous revolutionaries, Danton, he has a statue at Odeon in Paris, at the crossroads in Paris now, where he says that bread and education are the greatest gifts that a nation can give to its people. Okay, which is a wonderful quote to have on your statue. But what they don't quote is all the speeches where he said, let's have some blood, and the speeches where he was condoning prison massacres, where people would just mobs would go into prisons, massacre aristocrats, but also some of them wandered into a women's prison, raped loads of women, massacred some of the prostitutes, and claimed it as a revolutionary act. And people in this was by this time, this was during the terror, the Robespierre and co. and Danton were condoning this, and knowing that doesn't get quoted these days, you know. And one of the most famous revolutionaries is Marat, the fellow who famously died in his bath, you know, stabbed in his bath. One of the most bloodthirsty people you can imagine. He was calling for blood and guts the whole time, and he was pasting this on the walls of Paris every day. And that's what went wrong, is the sheer violence that they went. I don't understand it. You know, the massacres I talk about, you know, they were drowning, for example, thousands of people in the town of Nantes in Brittany, which today is a nice sort of picturesque, quiet place. There was a huge prison there, and I think it's about 9,000 people were thrown in the river or hacked to death. They used to do things, they called it a revolutionary wedding, where they would take a man and a woman, strip them naked, tie them together and throw them in the river. They thought it was a big joke, revolutionary death. You read these stories, you can't imagine how the French ever got together as a nation again. There was just such awful civil war. The English Civil War, there were no massacres like this. You know, so, yeah, I think that explains the divisions in France there are today. That explains why, for example, in the Second World War, suddenly you had, you know, resistance people on one side and then the Vichy on the other. The country just split down the middle. You know, that's what it can do, that, because it goes right back to the revolution.
Considering all this horrific bloodshed, civil war, massacres, if we compared France before the revolution and France after the revolution, what differences would we see? How would the two compare?
Well, this is something I go into at the end, is that what did the first revolution, if you want to call it that, the 1789, what did it actually achieve? And in the short term, there was, at the end of it, there was a measure of democracy in that more people had the vote. Taxes were lower because either they'd been abolished or people didn't bother to pay them, or their landowners, their landlords had gone into exile or been killed. So in that way, they were better off. Industry had come to almost a complete halt because most of the rich, industrialists had also been noble, so they'd mostly left. The country, lots of the chateaus had been sold off, but all the money had gone to the rich bourgeois people who'd stepped into the aristocrat's shoes, and they'd got rich by buying these wonderful chateaus for almost nothing. So for your average poor person, not a great deal had changed. And I go into the sexism of it all. Women had not got the vote. They were, they still had almost no rights whatsoever right through the 19th century because of it. So in the first instance, there wasn't a great deal of change. Slavery was briefly abolished, but then made legal again. And all that happened was that the first revolution created this vacuum into which Napoleon stepped. You know, this young general just walked in there. There was a power vacuum. He took over the country, became a dictator, got himself named emperor, and suddenly, just less than a decade after the revolution, France was now it wasn't a monarchy anymore, but it was an empire with an emperor, with a crown on the throne. You know, it didn't achieve a great deal at first.
So I wonder, maybe perhaps in conclusion, whether you could sum up how we should look back on the revolution.
I think, as with all history, the best thing to do is to go back and see what people were actually saying at the time. This is why I went back to the parliamentary archives, to autobiographies. Many of the autobiographies were self-defense, obviously. There were loads of aristocrats and royal servants writing. But when you go back and you see what was actually being said and done, you get a much clearer picture of what happened. And with the French Revolution, what you see at first is this democratization process that suddenly went horrifically and violently wrong. Now, it took them a century to pull themselves together and get something much more democratic going. So now they're at the Fifth Republic. I mean, they've had five goes at doing it. So looking back, I would say French Revolution is a lot less simple, cut and dried, if that's not a bad pun, than what's presented to us. And a lot more violent. It started out much more peaceful than people would imagine, and it ended up much, much more violent.
That was Stephen Clark. The French Revolution and What Went Wrong is out now, published by Century. And if this has whetted your appetite for French history, then you may well be interested in our Buy a Tapestry Day, taking place in Oxford on the 17th of June. Head to historyextra.com/events for more details on that. And that is all for today's episode. Thanks for listening, and do look out for our next episode, which will be released on Thursday.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.